KTMIT.
Go right ahead, Jeff, and I've got some opinions too. Jeff first, you got it, Jeff.
There's a company in Japan. They don't sell directly in the U.S., but if you contact them, they will sell to you. They won't sell you the batteries, but you can buy them. It bolts to the bottom of the SD817, which I have. I don't have the ND version. I just have the 817 version. It takes 27 milliamp hour batteries, and Maha makes a charger that will charge 8. So you need to buy 2 Maha chargers, and essentially you double the capacity of the Yaesu pack. You still get 5 watts out. You're not going to increase the output, but you get double the output, double the power, I should say, in a package that adds about a pound and a half to the unit, and it just take off the bottom and you screw this unit in. If you want some more information, I'll email to you. The name of the company escapes me, but I have the unit downstairs. You can send an email to k2mit@arrl.net, back to net.
Don, good information, Jeff. You said the 16 cells are 27 milliampere hours each. I wonder if you mean 2700. You said 27 milliampere hours each. That sounds like an awful low number. Back to you on that one, Jeff.
Yeah, brain drain, 2700. I thought I said 2700. They're either 2300 or 2700. They're Sanyos. They're hard to find. Normally they sell it with the kit. For some reason they won't ship it because it's OMRD. They won't ship it overseas. I guess batteries go by boat. So, but you can get, I bought them through Amazon. They weren't too expensive. And Dick, let me know. I do have a question still. I'm not sure when you end this. And let me know if you think you'll get to my question or not. No troubles if you can't.
Comment.
We're going to get to your question.
Erica sells those Sanyos. I got it at Ham Ventures. This is KB2MAR.
Mr. MAR, please repeat what you just said.
Those Sanyo 2700 milliamp hour batteries, I purchased them at from Batteries America. I went to Ham Ventures. Now, I don't know if they have those things, if you can contact the company direct, because I don't see it on their website. But at the booth at Hamvention, they were selling them, 2700 with solder tabs and without solder tabs. Back to you.
That's very good to know. When it comes to handy talkies, where the highest requirement there is to have long battery life on a very efficient radio, and you take a radio like an IC2AT, in the standby mode, it draws 20 milliamperes, and I think that's with the receiver active but not producing any audio, just like a dead carrier, so to speak. But unfortunately, a radio like that can overload very easily. The dynamic range is nowhere near as what you would like. You operate that on the 50th floor of the Empire State Building, even though you're 30 floors away from the transmitters above that building, that you're going to get all kinds of overload characteristics. I've seen the 817 radio, beautiful radio, and I believe it's got a rather high dynamic range receiver. Therefore, by definition, instead of it drawing 20 milliamperes in the receiver mode, if somebody told me it draws 300 milliamps or 500 milliamps in the receiver mode, I'd believe it. It's getting high dynamic range. By doing that, you have to make an investment in current to get dynamic range out of the IF strip of a receiver. As such, I am guessing an 817, a beautiful radio, is probably a battery eater, so to speak. Therefore, any of these gel cell-like battery packs, so lead-acid batteries and whatever, that can give you a whole lot of ampere hours in a somewhat reasonable size, I think is in order. So there are various companies that will sell you gel cell packs that have the right voltage and a whole lot of ampere hours. And if you're willing to carry that weight, I think you can get a lot longer life out of that particular radio system. That's another possible approach. Anyone else with further comments on Mel properly feeding his FT817? Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2KE1, 450 mils and receive.
What did I tell you? 450 mils and receive. Who was the other person who just signed in?
N2RDB.
N2, Romeo Delta Bravo is what it sounded like. start off with your name and then your comment on this subject, sir. K2RYW, my name is Dick.
Yeah, very good. This is Tim, November 2, Romeo Delta Bravo, portable. I got those Sanyo GE batteries, 2,700 milliamp hour AA's. I got them on Canal Street, and I have seen them at the ham fair, so they are around. I own an 817, and yes, it is a battery chomper. Nice little radio, though. Just really have a lot of fun with that.
John, good information, and thank you, Tim. Okay, let's see if you need any fills, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
As long as they'll fit in. See, I can't, you know, carry much more than that, than as long as they'll fit in the carrying case and all. That's the question I was just going to ask everybody. The question is, will this fit into the existing storage compartment for the batteries that is there now, or is it external something or another to the radio? In other words, I got a weight problem, of course, to some extent, but and also a size problem. So with these batteries, it sounds interesting. They will fit directly, I assume, into the compartment. Over.
Comment.
Yeah, I think you're gonna have a problem on that one, Mel. I don't think within the capacity you're given in order to make the package attractive, they give you anywhere near enough room to give you the number of hours you want with any reasonable kind of batteries. I think you're going to be forced into an external battery to get the life that you want. Let's see if other people can confirm that. Who would like to give us more information? Give me your call letters first. K2RIW.
K2MIT. 2RDB again.
Okay, here you go. Okay, I heard Jeff, Tim, and Eric in that order. Jeff first. Go ahead, Jeff, MIT.
Yeah, the device I bought directly from Japan, you take off the bottom and this thing attaches to the bottom, and it probably adds about one half of the height to the radio. It's still small, but there's no way to fit 16 batteries into that compartment. It's just impossible. It's meant to have a custom sized battery, and these are 16 non-soldered batteries. They're just, you know, you just drop them into a tray like you would like another appliance, and it bolts to the bottom of it. It's still pretty small. I can take a picture and send it to you if you want, but there's no free lunch, as they say. K2MIT.
The voltage is too high, by the way?
No, he's not worried. He wants more ampere hours so that he gets the right number of hours of operation of this beautiful radio called FT817. Tim, N2RDB, go right ahead with your suggestion.
N2EL.
We got Rich, too. Go ahead, Tim, first.
Yeah, thank you. The Sanyo GE rechargeable NIMH batteries are standard AA size. The 817 comes with a standard AA holder in addition to a battery pack. So you can run the thing off alkalines, and there is a way to actually run this thing off of those rechargeable batteries. There are two small mods. One of them involves a green wire. I remember reading that on mods.dk. But the other one is when you put the batteries in the holder and you install the standard AA alkaline holder, there is one area when you put the panel on where a piece of metal wants to come in contact with the corner of the battery. So you may have to scrape away the plastic in order to get those batteries to be able to charge properly. N2RDB.
Thank you, Tim. Sounds like another valuable piece of information. So, Eric, as you can tell, Mel would like to get, I'm going to pick a number, 4 or 5 hours of use out of a battery pack on an FT817 radio when he's at his remote location. And too bad he doesn't have an extension cord that could give him a wall wart charger to run it on. Well, how would you solve that problem, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KJRIW, KE2EJ. This all happens, I own an 817. And by the way, the 817's receiver is pretty much the same as an 857. It's just the same design. The board's similar. That sucker draws 130 milliamps, you know, when it's quiet. It really likes the structure. The gentleman that mentioned the green wire, if you cut the green wire, then the radio thinks that it's got NAC heads in it. With the green wire attached, it knows it's dealing with alkaline batteries. It has a higher voltage. Also, the circuit shuts down the charging circuit, so if you don't open up the green wire, you ain't charging no batteries. Really, what Mel should do is find himself a couple of flat lithium vinyl batteries. They're really thin. You can paste them on the bottom of the radio. And the only thing is you need a good charging circuit for it. And you can get hours and hours and oodles and oodles. The vinyl batteries that I saw that somebody else had pasted on the radio was about a little over 6,000 milliamp hours, so that just gives you a good chunk of time. But if you calculate it, it doesn't last that long, the normal stuff. K2IW, K2EJ.
Boy, that sounds like a nice solution. However, tell us the model number, the approximate cost of those super 6,000 milliampere hour batteries, and how expensive is the charger for those. So if Mel wants to make that investment, how difficult physically and how much of his wallet is going to be drained, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
First of all, nobody's selling lithium vinyls as a replacement for a ham radio. If you go to DigiKey or Mauser, you can buy your lithium vinyl batteries and the 6,000 milliamp hour jobs, I think, run around 60 or 70 bucks, something like that. It's a little expensive. And as far as the charger goes, you're going to have to make your own. I'm not aware of any that is designed for that. There's, well, the problem with lithium ions is that, any kind of lithium batteries that are rechargeable, there's usually some circuitry in the batteries that prevent you from overcharging it and making a lot of hydrogen gas and causing explosions. So, I have never seen a generic lithium ion charger because everybody who manufactures, like Sony, uses their chips and Panasonic uses theirs for their various different types of devices. So, you're kind of on your own with that one.
Are these batteries 3 volts each, or is it a series combo for 12 volts, back to you?
Yeah, I'm going to, when you said $60 for the battery, Eric, are you talking about per individual cell? And Mel may need 4 or 5 of those cells in order to make 12 volts. I'm assuming the main voltage running the radio is 12 volts. So is it $60 per cell? And also, most of the respective company using lithium-like rechargeable batteries usually have a very special circuit in each individual battery pack that protects it from overcurrent discharge and overvoltage charge, so you don't get all kinds of disadvantages of lithiums that have been mistreated. So a protection circuit is required. So give us a couple of words on the protection circuit and total cost of the battery. I'm presuming it's 12 volts worth that we need to power Mel. And how much research is he going to have to use in order to design the correct charger for this? It sounds like a fairly significant project. For you, it's easy. For the rest of us, mere mortals, I think we're going to have to work pretty hard at this one, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
No, it's really not that hard, Dick. First of all, that's for the multi-cell package that we're talking about. It's pretty flat. I think it, I don't remember the size of it, but it's a little smaller than the back case of the radio. They're flat. And as far as like the charging circuit goes, all you got to do is go to National Semi. They make a whole series of regulators and controllers, and Same thing with Maxim. All you got to do is look through the application notes to a particular type of cell that you're dealing with and buy the chip and build the circuit and you're all set to go. But yeah, you're going to find out with lithium ion is that, like, you know, if you have a camcorder that's got a lithium ion battery or even your laptop, you know, if you crack the thing open, you'll find a circuit board in there with a whole bunch of circuitry that does the job of keeping the battery not so damn dangerous. Back to you, Dick.
Thank you, Eric. Good information. Is there someone else that wanted to make another suggestion for Mel? Give me your call letters right now. Oh, I think it was Rich. N2EO. We're going to go to Rich first, and then I'll ask the question again. N2EO, how would you solve this problem, Rich? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Well, I'll tell you, I owned an 817. I did not care for the radio. Barry M2MB owns one and is going to get rid of it. I had looked into something else, a commercial man pack. Never did anything about it, but maybe a little extreme. But, you know, you can get a commercial man pack, which is a 100-watt single sideband transceiver, 1.5 continuous to 30 megs. They run about $1,500. They're bigger than the 817. They do use a rechargeable pack, and the pack will presumably last a period of time because it's sideband. It's not, you know, continuous carrier output. That's something I looked into. You can go on Google and type in Manpack radio. You'll see a number of them come from Europe, like Denmark, and I think Sweden. I forget where that was. One company I had looked at about 4 or 5 years ago, I looked into this, but one of them came from either Denmark or Sweden. There's a whole bunch of these things around. The commercial radios are much tougher than the 817. They come with a long telescopic antenna. They're real radios, not the toy like the 817, but they're more money. Go ahead, Dick.
Hey, I got something to say about that.
Comment?
Yeah, I heard Eric and another person, which is probably Jeff. Yeah, for a well-heeled guy like you, Rich, just going out and buying another expensive radio is a great solution. Mel and I were a little bit more tight on our wallet, if you know what I mean. Eric first, KE2EJ. Go ahead, Eric, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, well, the thing that people don't like about the radio is the receiver is the same receiver as on the 857D. There's no difference circuitry-wise. It's the same. The problem with the 817 is the transmitter. The same set of output transistors run all the way from 1.6 to UHF. They use the same output transistors, so they have a tendency to go south on you. One of them tends to open up, and it doesn't really give you, say, 5 watts on 2 meters in UHF. It's a little less than that. I mean, it's kind of interesting how they managed to get those two surface mount transistors and go beryllium cases. And I've replaced many of them, I'll tell you that. K2RIWK, KJ.
Does somebody make a more rugged output? I mean, how did you solve the problem of the output transistors burning up so frequently? And is it more vulnerable when you use it on 70 centimeters? Is there any solution for that output transistor failure that you know of, Eric? Go ahead.
I got a battery coming.
Okay, well, we'll get you in a minute. Go ahead, Eric.
Now, what I've done with mine, and since I've done it, I haven't had a problem, but I put some extra heat sinks on it. The way the transistors are mounted, they expect that the base is going to take away the heat. Well, because of the way they've manufactured and the surface mount, the amount of contact that you get underneath is fairly adequate, but they can do better. And by the way, they're a real pest to get out. You need a good air blaster to get them hot enough to loosen them up. But, they try to do a lot in a very small space. Back to you, Dick.
What did you do to give him a better heatsink, Eric?
You know, I have my mini mill, and I milled myself a piece of, a hunk of aluminum that doesn't quite touch anything, but touches the conductive surface of the transistor, and distributes the heat a little more on the other side, because they use the chassis as a heat sink, so take it from there. I mean, you've got all that other stuff generating heat along with the transistor itself, so add all that up, and you get a pretty high junction temperature.
Yep. And as you rate the life of solid-state active devices versus temperature, the cooler you can keep them, the longer they'll last. The extra battery information, I think it was Jeff. Go ahead, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I can't remember the gentleman's name who was looking for one. What I do when I take the FT817 out, and I tend to find that I drive places, I don't hike, so if you hike, this isn't the solution, but I tend to drive places to camp. I got a really small motorcycle battery, and then use Anderson power pole connectors, the blade connector to the, you know, to the positive and negative connection, and then there's a company, QSRradio.com, they sell all the power pole connectors, and they make a power pole connector for the 817, and I just connected the two with the Anderson power poles. And with a small motorcycle battery, I think they weigh like 5 or 6 pounds. You could talk for a whole weekend with the thing, but you got to realize you're taking it with you. But you know, if you're going camping and you're bringing your tent and all your other stuff, it's only another thing to bring. So, but it's definitely not a walkabout situation. Over.
GC2WGB with a question from Mel.
Now, one of the other things Mel could do, I like the idea of the motorcycle battery, a gel cell or lead acid battery, even though it's got a little bit of extra weight. He puts it on the right kind of a cart, a right kind of a two-wheeled dolly-like thing to use for carrying your suitcase at an airport, since he's walking across nice marble floors, wheeling this thing behind him, even though it's got some extra weight. The weight doesn't count anymore. John, KC2WGB, go right ahead. K2RAW in the TechNet.
Hey, Dick, I forgot to mention that there's a company that makes a bottom foot that uses a gel cell.
Oh, ho, that's nice to know. Roughly how expensive is that, Eric?
I don't honestly remember, but I think it was like close to $100.
Okay, that's the way to go. John, you've got it.
Good evening, Dick. No. No, we got a question for you. Does that have an external power jack or plug, and is it 12 volts?
You got a connection on the rear that you can put in 12 volts. I've got the modification also that was a QST to detect, you know, reverse polarity, and a regulator, high spool regulator device in there, so that the radio does not have to require. It runs the radio a little cooler, in fact. I think, Eric, are you familiar with what I'm talking about, the modification that sits onto the rear of the radio? Over.
Yeah, I think I brushed across that one. You know, the radio really likes 13 volts rather than 12, but, you know, it'll take anything you can give it.
Hey, you got to worry about the fact that there are certain radios, like one of my favorites, the Kenwood 751, I think it is, the 2-meter all-mode rig. I'm looking at one right now, and it's a Kenwood 751A. Runs beautifully on 12 volts and greater. You give it 11.99 volts in the sideband mode, and it puts out a signal that you don't want anybody to hear. Over to you, Eric, Mel, for any fills on all this. K2KEY, K2RIW.
NY2FI.
And I do have a suggestion for you, Mel.
Very good. Yeah, well, the 817, I have run it down with the bulges, like, you know, just the battery pack that thinks the goose, wow, very, oh, gee, I don't know, 8.5 volts or whatever it is. And it works. Works well, just like I say. It lasts very long. anything that you use. Let's see. Here's the battery pack that I have. It's 9.6 volt NiCad pack, which actually is 8 AA batteries. It was available either. You can put it into the pack yourself. They supply you, you know, with the assembly. You can plug the batteries in, or you can buy the pack, the FD828 or something like that. That's basically so. Ryan, works good, the radio, at 9.6 volts. So, no, I can't carry a motorcycle battery with me or anything. This is just about where I can go, and it's at my maximum, because instead of carrying the handy talkie, I can make this, but not much more. I have a unique problem. Got to get on the subway at 5:30 in the morning and whatever, and rush hours on the way home, and all kinds of problems. So it was just something to think about in the meantime, to just relieve some of the pressure, tension, or just break up the monotony. Over.
Interesting. Quite a problem. And I'm amazed that a radio made for 12 volts nominal and 13.8 volts is what you get out of an automobile, and this could be used mobile. I'm amazed that it gives full performance at 9.6 volts. In the receive mode, I'll believe it. In the transmit mode, I'm a little bit skeptical. I think I heard NY2SI, November Yankee 2, Sierra India. If you've got some suggestions on this one, start off with your name, sir, and your suggestion. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Be skeptical, Dick.
I believe you. Go ahead, NY2SI. Go ahead.
Okay, very good, Dick. Thank you very much. Good evening to all on the net. The name here is Mo, and we're out in San Juan. Coming in through IRLP. Real quick, I have a Whiskey Amion battery pack that I purchased on eBay that fits perfectly into the 817. Comes from China. It runs about $100 with the shipping. And I believe it's 7,500 milliampere hours. It's 3,2500 milliampere hour flat cells. So again, this is Mo, back to net. This is NY2SI.
That sounds like a darn nice unit, Mo. Mel, do you want any further information? That sounds like it might be a solution. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Sounds like a real good one. What is the name of that company, and who sells it? Any of the distributors? Any of the popular distributors in the United States? Is that available, or you got to go to China for it? Over.
You got it, Mo.
Yeah, unfortunately, you have to get it from China, and I bought it via eBay. It came fairly quickly. He uses some sort of drop shipping service, so, you know, you're not waiting more than maybe a week or two. And the brand on the battery pack, which, again, is three flat 2,500 milliampere hour cells, is WindCamp, one word, WindCamp. But the eBay seller is a long, hard to pronounce name, but I can email you the information, Mel. Back to you.
And Mel, do you want to give him an email address so he can mail you that information? You got it, Mel?
Thought everybody knows mine by now. K2KEY at ARRL.net. Appreciate it. I will look into it. Sounds like the best solution so far, because, like I say, I have no options here except to keep this thing in, you know, just basically the way it is, with its carrying case, the straps, and all that business. And more or less, it'll just be for receiving. I'm not going to do much in the way of transmitting unless I do get on maybe 2 meters or 440 or whatever once in a while, maybe on one of the repeaters. But mostly receiving. If I can just listen to some HF, CW, you know, things like that, tune around the band, tunes around and all, that more or less would suffice, really, what I want to do with the 817. I'm not looking to do any miracles there. And, you know, I can't I can't run extension cords or make myself, you know, obnoxious in any way. I got to plug a little headphone in and listen with it and everything. So I'm sure a lot of people up there would not appreciate hearing CW in the background. So it's just something, like I say, to break up some of the monotony. Something, you know, a little different for a change. Over.
Recommendation, Dick.
Yeah, John recognized. John recognized, but I'm going to back to Mo for a minute there. Mo, you said, I think it's around $100, wind cam. You said 3 times 2,500 ampere hours, I think you said. How many cells do you believe it puts out 12 volts, and what's the ampere hours, Mel, NY2SI, K2RIW?
Yeah, okay, Dick, very good. It's the voltage listed on the battery pack, I'm holding it in my hand right now, is 9 to 12.6 volts. I'm looking at the pack. There are three flat cells that are sort of bonded together in a plastic shell. And it says 2,500 milliamp per hour, but I believe that's per cell. I found that it gave me really good battery life, especially if you're just using it on receive. And also, it does come with the charger. The only catch is you have to charge it out external to the radio. You do have to take the battery pack out and use the charger that it came with. You can't charge it using the radio's internal charging circuitry. Back to that, NY2SI.
Yeah, with that kind of performance, I guarantee Mel's willing to disconnect it in order to charge it. What's your guess as to why they say 9 to 12.6? Why that voltage range, Mo, if you happen to know? Back to you, Mo.
I was wondering about that. I'm looking at the description on the eBay auction, and it says the same thing on the eBay description. It says maximum voltage 12.6, voltage range 9 to 12.6. I know the radio, you know, will run on as little as 9 volts. I don't know why, you know, why the voltage would vary, unless the cells have, different voltage characteristics. Back to you.
I have an answer, Dick.
Go ahead, Eric.
It doesn't have a charge shunt regulator in it. If you look at the curve of lithium ion, it sounds like really a lithium vinyl pack. It starts off nominally at 12 volts and then works its way down to around 9-something, and it's kind of logarithmic if you look at the graph, so that's probably why they rate it that way.
Okay, and a radio that's happy at 8.5 volts, looks like that's a possible winner. John, KC2WGB, go ahead, K2RIW in the tech net.
Okay, Dick. The original question that I asked Mel about the 12 volts in the power jack, I was going to suggest he could also stop at a photo shop. They make very small, high-density batteries that clip on the belt. They're very tiny. They come with Velcro-type belts and all, and you can stack them. That might be the way to go, being that it's 12 volts. There's a lot out there available.
John, you got a guess as to how many ampere hours he can get on something that he can clip to his belt? Make a rough guess on ampere hours, John.
I know my friend has 2-pack, and he has, I think, 3,000. That's about all I know about him, but I'm sure that he can get all that information at the photo stores, because the photogs, they use that stuff like crazy. In fact, Eric might even know about that.
That's what I do.
Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, for the amateur photographer, they have very small gel cell packs that are, they run about anywhere from 2,000 to 5,000 milliamp hours. The reason for that is long duration shooting, and the other is short duration running sun gun lamps. But I mean, if you don't mind an extra couple of pounds on your belt, then, you know, I can get you like 10, 15 amp hour battery belts, and those are light compared to the normal ones, which are more like 35, you know, but they weigh a lot of pounds. You don't want to be dragging that around with you. I have a question for Mel. What kind of antennas are you using where he's going?
I'm using one of those Wonder Whips they had, a thing to make an antenna up. It was in one of the articles. I got a whole bunch of things on the 817, so one of these little tchotchke-gotchke gadgets that defy physics. It's a little tap coil, basically, Eric. Like I say, it's not going to, you know, I'm not expecting, you know, anything other than some amusement, Eric, and No, I can't add any more weight. I've got to carry with me your paperwork and stuff and the radio, and I got another things I must have with me. So I'm just about at my maximum. I just thought maybe I could just squeeze a little more with the 817. So if I can put a battery pack in there, give me a reasonable amount of time, I'll give it a shot. But believe me, I'm in a situation, especially going home, that every little bit of weight, maybe adding another pencil in my pocket, maybe, as they say, the straw that breaks the camel's back, over.
Yeah, I got you. Well, I got to admit, when I travel Europe, when I go straight to Japan, I take that radio with me. And it's fun to operate a cap, and the antenna's always been the big issue. And I've made a number of different kind of antennas to work with that, including a couple of Komofa ones that have the little cooners in them. And even though it's, flea power, you can still do a pretty good job with it.
Oh, yeah, Roger. I made a number of contacts with the thing. I've worked some real good DX, but I've hooked it up to a 916. But as far as the radio itself, yeah, I had the radio down at the park a number of times and used a little bit better of an antenna. I clamped it onto a railing there, and it worked. Quite a number of stations, really. Was really pleased how it worked. This is just, like I say, something to just sort of give me something else to think about during the daytime. So, like I say, if I can just have some new toy to play with, maybe it just would help out. And that's basically not looking for any miracles with it, Eric. Or what?
All right. Well, in terms of where you go and how you set it up and how you move it, the meter on the front of it, not all that helps. You've got stuff like the Miracle Whip and Yates yourself there, a little thing and what they were making. It's all a matter of where you put the radio. You're kind of sitting on top of it, but you go near it, it changes. But, sideband or CW is really great. And can have a lot of fun with it. You get a little more juice, you get a little more power. Back to you, Dick. K2RWK, to Dick.
Okay, thank all you guys for lots of good information. I know that Jeff's been waiting patiently, so Jeff, K2MIT, go right ahead with your question. K2RIW.
Thanks. So I got a satellite rig, FT-827, and I didn't want to spend money, so I guess I sort of look like, rods that sort of, look like several circles, and I guess they look like wondering just how well they work. I'm that don't work, but you would need alt azimuth mounted baggy. On how well these egg beater type antennas work, it will be a preamp on each, and that's my question. So. Thanks for hanging in there, and I do appreciate it. K2MIT.
Now, once again, repeat the question, because I missed little portions of it, Jeff. I heard a number of questions along those lines, but I missed some of the details. So back to you again, Jeff. K2MIT, K2RIW.
RM, can you hear me? Can you hear me okay?
60 over is that now.
So go ahead.
Okay, I'm going to try my hand out at some of the satellite work. So I bought an FT-847 egg beater antenna. I'm going to put on my tower as opposed to rotator and four Yagis. I was just plane really work best when the satellite is directly over, when they're a horizon. I don't know how well they work for people, being new to all of this. So those are my questions. Hope you hear me, Dick, and the other people.
Is it Oscar-like satellites that you're attempting to use? Something like a 2 meter, 430. Here we go, 435 megacycle uplink and 2 meter downlink. Is that the kind of stuff you're trying to work? Jeff, go ahead.
Yes, QSL.
And there, I think, I believe they want a very specific amount of uplink power. Something in the vicinity of 10 watts of EIRP. I'm speaking now in the old days. In the old days, they wanted something like 10 watts of EIRP. If you exceeded that, you would be capturing too much of the power capability of the satellite, and the net result is you would be, because of its automatic gain control circuitry, you would be robbing power that other people would normally use and you could suck down. So I don't know now if the modern-day satellites still have that same limitation of around 10 watts. I think you could stretch it to 20, but you're not supposed to go to 100 or 200 watts of ERP. Otherwise, you're capturing too much of the satellite's capability. Let me drop.
All that satellite was linear sound waves.
Particularly the ones with the linear translator, there's where the uplink power, they want to eliminate it. They want to limit it even further, as I understand, Eric, for reasons of you not capturing the whole AGC circuit and sucking everyone down. So I think it's the linear translators that are most limited in uplink power. Did I get that wrong? KE2EJ? K2RIW?
No, that's exactly right. The whole idea with the linear translators, you're supposed to run, like you're supposed to be listening to yourself. You're supposed to run just enough power to hear yourself come back. And that's it. You don't want to do any more than that because it just sucks the whole thing down. But the repeaters, the ones that are operated in the repeaters, mode K, I forget what mode it is, there you don't have that issue. Whoever's the strongest is getting in.
And yes, on the linear repeater type satellites, it is recommended that you go just beyond the point where you see yourself. However, there's a catch on that. If you happen to have a dead receiver where your noise figure is limited and your downlink limited, in other words, you're not hearing the full dynamic range of the satellite is transmitting, you're hearing mostly limitation of your own noise figure and gain of your own antenna, noise figure of your front end and gain of your own antenna. If you're downlink limited, you can make the mistake of transmitting enough uplink power so that you hear yourself coming back down on the other frequency in the downlink, and you could be running way above the recommended power and capturing the automatic gain control of the circuit and sucking everyone else down. So it's a common problem. So by some means, like making a sun noise measurement, you should confirm what the gain to temperature ratio, in other words, sensitivity, of your downlink receiver is before using that exclusively, just adjusting uplink power until you hear yourself. When it comes to the antennas that everybody uses on the uplink, to my knowledge, you're way ahead of the game to use circular polarization if that hasn't changed a lot. The satellite is going to favor clockwise or counterclockwise. I'm going to guess clockwise on the uplink. Let me drop. And one of the nicest ways to get the most amount of gain and the smallest package for the smallest amount of square feet of wind load and the smallest number of pounds are crisscrossed Yagis. In other words, on one single boom, you have some horizontal elements of a Yagi, some vertical elements of a Yagi, a little bit displaced in the Z direction so that they don't intercept each other. Two separate feed lines going into the right kind of a network, which adjusts the phase power splits and adjust the phase accordingly so that one signal is 90 degrees ahead of the other when sensed in free space, and now you're making pure circular polarization. And then by having the right circular polarization on the uplink and the downlink, you get a lot more performance out of the antenna. Guys have done it with linear antennas, but you tend to end up with some wow as the satellite rotates. So my recommendation is crisscross Yagis for both the uplink and the downlink. I think it's a very successful antenna. I know that there are people who have used no steering of the, by the way, I think you're forced into steering of the antenna to make sure you've got enough sensitivity in the downlink. Once you accept steering of the antenna, you might as well do it on the transmitter also. Although there have been people that use very simple ground plane-like antennas with enough transmitting power and don't bother aiming the antenna on the uplink, only aim the antenna on the downlink. I wonder if you've heard of situations like this, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KE2RIW, K2EJ. As you know, I run circularly polarized antennas just for that purpose. Actually, there's a bunch of guys on a couple of the birds that do exactly that. And the sun noise measurement is an excellent way to see the performance of your system and how it's operating. And there are a lot of people that make the mistake of running too much power. But the number of linear translators it doesn't seem to be the major mode of operation these days for a lot of the satellites. The good ones, of course, are dead. And so you have fewer choices, and a lot of them run the FM and DGPeter mode. So. And also, some of the satellites, you have to check the schedule as to when they're doing what. K2RIW, K2J.
Very fine, Eric. Good information. Are there other satellite-oriented people on frequency right now that can give us some more specific information as to the recommended antennas that that Jeff should be using? Give me your call letters right now, K2RIW on the TechNet. I was wishing we had a little bit more satellite experience here to help you, Eric. K2MIT, K2RIW, I mean Jeff, K2MIT, K2RIW, go ahead, Jeff. Boy, I want to call you everything else. Jeff, you've got it, K2RIW.
Thanks. You and Eric did a fine job. I appreciate it. And my dog is looking at me like he really has to go out. He's been waiting this whole TechNet to go outside and do his thing. So I'm going to say 7-3. It's always a pleasure. Always a pleasure. K2MIT, clear. Back to net.
I have a recommendation, Dick.
On a quick wake, report to your dog's name. But Eric first. Go ahead, Eric.
Kushkoff makes a pair of antennas for his VHF and UHF. They're circularly polarized. They're cross-beam antennas. You can choose left or right-hand polarization remotely. And if you're serious about doing linear satellite work as opposed to the repeated satellite work, it's a different world. You really need a good satellite tracking program. And beyond that, it's good to have it derived an antenna that's an ASL-mounted antenna. And if it's really smart, because all the programs are smart, you'll actually hook up the frequency control, which will automatically move the frequency according to the Doppler shift as the satellite makes the pass. So you can use some really old stuff. AMSAT is a good choice for that kind of stuff. They have a good tracking program. It's a little pricey, and there's an interface box for like the A2 controller. They also have a general purpose box that you could use a couple of radio tracks rotated. And the other important thing is you want to mount the two antennas on a non-insulating piece of pipe, I mean a non-conducting piece of pipe. If you buy the actual cross beam set, it comes with a fiberglass pipe that holds the two of them up. K2RIW,
John, good information, and thank you, Eric. Need any fills, Jeff?
No, that comes with a fiberglass mask, and I was wondering why, and you gave it. The dog's name is Oreo, and he started to eat my wife's shoes, so I got to take him out. K2MIT. See you guys next week.
Bye-bye, Oreo and Jeff. KTRIW listening.
WV2U, Paul, with a quick comment on the satellite.
WV2U, go right ahead, Paul.
Yeah, I was working both linear and the FM repeater satellites for a while, and I had a very simple antenna system, essentially just a cheap little TV rotor, and I didn't worry about elevation angle, just azimuth. And what I did is I used, because the Ford 32 antenna, which didn't have that many elements, but it really seemed to have quite a null at high angles of elevation, I have a switch, and I switched over to my egg beater, and I would use the egg beater for the 432 downlink when the elevation angle of the satellite became too high. And that was a very simple solution, and I did use a satellite tracking program from AMSAT, the SAT-PC-32, hooked up to the 840.
I wonder if you're still there, Paul. You cut off mid-sentence. I guess it's possible that Paul ran out of battery. I'll give it a little bit of more standby. Okay. I think we've gone down the list of everyone who signed in. Let me double-check to make sure I haven't skipped anybody. And let's make a quick get, listen to see if Paul's got anything for us. WS2N, K2RIW. Sounds like Paul does not. And now as I look at spectrometers, one of the subjects that John and Wesley have been studying this week, if I understand correctly. Start off with John first. What's your impression of spectrometers, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
One more thing, Dick, K2KY.
Go ahead, Mel.
Yeah, we picked up the mailbag just as Glenn was wanted to say something, so I apologize that I did interrupt him. So if you would like to pick up Glenn and find out what his comment or question was previous to the mailbag, over.
Yeah, I'm glad you reminded me. Glenn, KC2QIQ, go right ahead, and I hope you're still up at this late hour. KQRIW, the TechNet. And Glenn, if you're away from the transmitter, but you're hearing us, come back whenever you can. John, KC2WGB, give us a word on spectrometers if that's the main subject of tonight. KQRIW, the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Actually, that's something Wesley's looking into. I really don't know much about that, although I did work with an HP gas chromatic analyzer. But if for some reason he seems to be researching that, so I guess pick it up with him. Back to you, Dick.
You got it, Wesley.
Yeah, I was looking at eBay, and they found spectrometers, different kind of different spectrometers. And then I was looking at that information. It's not a major subject. It's just a short subject that I wanted to cover. Spectrometry of different kinds allows you to analyze the metals in the substance of wafers of water, metals in the soil, and they use a carbide to tunneling for the atomic concentration and being able to measure that. The Hidden is the company that makes the spectrometry at first, and they also are able to discover the metal vapors in the air or in the gases. So I had a few questions in this area. Also, when I was doing, name it, research for the glowing circle of Thomson and Tesla. They can jump. We have seen in the glass envelope a glowing, glowing circle, so that was a plasma. And then spectrometer allows also the plasma ions and neutrons and radials to be measured. I thought the spectrometer might be also good for creating artificial aurora study. And another question that came is that metal vapors in metallic organic vapors could be also discovered. So the question is, does the metal have a vapor? Then itching. You can have a itching of the metal by using the electron bombardment in a high voltage environment. So then edge point detection in ion beam itching application, that's where the spectrometry is being used. So it is nice to see the metal itch by bombardment of electrons. If you have any information about this area, I would appreciate I sent you the number of links to cover that, and then we go further.
Yeah, I was at I was away much of this weekend, didn't get a chance to study those links, but this is what little I know on the subject. When you operate a spectrometer, I think the majority of them require the substance being analyzed to be in the gaseous form. And can metal be turned into a gas? Absolutely. Everything in the world has a freezing temperature where it becomes solid, a melting temperature where it becomes a liquid, a boiling temperature in which it becomes a gas. Everything has a, with rare exception, has a gaseous temperature. So you use a high enough temperature applied to the substance you're measuring, you can get it in the gaseous form. Once you've got the cloud of material and you're aiming a known beam of signal, call it light or whatever, you're aiming a beam through it, the individual molecules that are in the gaseous cloud have their individual resonances which will affect the transmissivity of the gas. And my understanding is that a spectrometer measures those suckouts by looking, for instance, let me drop. By looking at the spectral lines of emission and the spectral lines of suckout of that plasma called sun, the sun has a very specific signature of peaks and valleys at various wavelengths of its emission. And by studying those peaks and valleys, you can figure out with rather high accuracy how much helium, how much hydrogen, how much lithium, how much iron, how much of each one of the elements, how much each one of the elements are present in this particular star that we call the sun. And you can do a similar study on the spectrum of essentially every other star that you see. Therefore, you can figure out what the star is made out of, how big is the star, how hot is the star. All of these clues give you a very good chance to make a prediction as to how big, how far, and how old is that star. So by remote spectrometry techniques, you can find out an awful lot about a star that might be some ridiculous number of light years or billions of light years away from you. Let me drop. My understanding of the terrestrially bound spectrometers is they work by a fairly similar process. So I think the majority of them require the material to be analyzed to be in the gaseous form. I suspect there are other kinds of spectrometers where if you put the material to be analyzed in a vacuum and aim a beam of electrons at it, I suspect there are ways you can do a kind of X-ray spectrometry in that manner. In other words, you can do a kind of an experiment where you look at the angles of all of these signals that bounce off of the material when you put a known beam into it. I think there's ways of doing that. As you can tell, I've never used a spectrometer of the kind that does chemical analysis. Yes, I've used radio spectrum analyzers, lots of them. and I was the engineering manager once for a department that was engineering spectrum analyzers for Airborne Instruments Laboratory way back in the 1970s, and I've seen lots of kinds of spectrum analyzers, and properly used, boy, they can give you a lot of information, more than 100 or 110 decibels of dynamic.